Hello, this is John Costa, Spotlight on Heritage Show here at the University of Leicester for the Heritage Hub.
And this is Rob Watson, and we're just going to wander around and have a conversation with people at the Heritage event. What's this about?
Well, it's about the university being able to showcase its resources to the local heritage sector in the region, I'd say, and make them aware of the services that the university has got in-house, like researchers and bits and pieces, but then for them to learn as well about what the heritage sector is about. So I think it's a really good initiative that, you know, once a year has this sort of annual under one roof, bringing people together to be able to kind of, you know, proactively network. Yeah.
Now you're here to show your heritage work. What have you got on display today?
Well, it's a challenge, isn't it? I mean, what do you actually show people that are interested in heritage themselves? It's as much showcasing what we do to the stallholders as it is from, you know, members of the public. So from our perspective, it's about saying to people, we've got an independent heritage network that sort of is responsible for our own four independent museums that we've got. So Dot Media Centre, which is about sort of technology, cameras, the 120 plus cameras we've got on projectors. Then the Museum of Community Media, which is the archive of Citizen's Eye, but also has things like the 300 copies of the Evington Echo from its 40-year heritage. So looking for more collections like that that we can have. Then we've got the Conflict Memory Education Centre, sort of sharing with people those kind of stories of people that have been involved in conflicts from around the world, both as combatants, but also as, you know, family members left at home or people that have kind of migrated, kind of quite a broad sector. And then the final museum we've got is Living Heritage Education Centre, and that's about looking to artists and creatives about how they can look at their own portfolio when it comes to, you know, like creatives as collectors, thinking about how that fits in with maybe intangible heritage as well, and links to our Parallel Lives Network, which is 120 countries of the Global South, and sort of how we use those things to be able to do it. And some amazing conversations, as always. Lots of people interested in the technology, which is so it always works. It brings people in, the cameras. And it's just a thoroughly enjoyable day. And before you know it, you know, 4 hours have gone and here we are.
Tell us, what's your name? Tell us what you're doing here today.
Hi, I'm Dr. James Moore, and I work for the Centre for Urban History at Leicester University, and we're promoting our MA in Urban Conservation.
And what does that involve?
The MA in Urban Conservation is a training programme for urban conservation professionals. So every local authority has an urban conservation member as part of their planning team, looking after historic buildings in the city or town where they're from. And we train people to do that type of work. So we're training people to essentially protect ancient buildings, to understand what's needed to protect those buildings. And we also provide training also for the private sector, for developers and for architects who need to also have that sort of skill level.
So we're here in Leicester University, or University of Leicester, and why is that then relevant? What would listeners in Leicester look out for to notice about why that was? It's important to preserve our architectural heritage?
Well, we've got a huge range of historic buildings in Leicester. Obviously, we've got the Roman buildings that are essentially ruins, but we've also got the Guildhall, we've got the medieval buildings, we've got 19th century heritage, and we've got important modern heritage as well. So we've got some fantastic modern buildings like the engineering building at Leicester University, which is it's often said to be the first postmodern building in England. Certainly the best postmodern building on a university campus. So these are, you know, important assets to protect. And we want to look after our city in the long term and protect its cultural heritage. Protecting its buildings is a very important part of that.
And I suppose cities and urban places are constantly changing and growing. And there's a tendency, I think, when you look back at Leicester, that we've taken out parts like building the Ring Road, and we've taken out things which now would be, you know, maybe they'd be frowned upon now, but you've still got to keep it moving forward and respect that. How do you get that balance right?
It's difficult, and it's important to emphasise that urban conservation is not about saving absolutely every building and protecting every building, but it's It's making an assessment of the things that are important to ourselves as a city, thinking about what's important in terms of the future. What are the outstanding buildings? What are the distinctive buildings that we value as part of our townscape on an everyday basis? So they may not even be the very famous buildings like the Clock Tower, but they might be shops or they might be hotels, like the Grand Hotel, for example, which has recently undergone a major programme of restoration and refurbishment. So it's about thinking about, as a community, trying to think about what we want to protect for the future and making sure that the right policies and the right practices are in place to do that.
And what are your favourite places when you're walking around Leicester?
That's a very good question. Well, I'm a big fan of the New Walk area. I think that's a very good example of urban conservation that goes really back to the late 1960s, where the city took a view this is a very important asset to the whole of the community, and put in places policies that mean that it's still a fantastic site to walk through today. It's a wonderful corridor between the university and the city centre. I walk down it almost daily, and I think it's a wonderful asset to the city, and it just demonstrates what can be achieved if the city and the local people work together and have the appropriate policies in place to protect our historic environment.
I'm David Wykes. I'm here with the Leicestershire Archaeological and Historic Society, and I've been associated as an officer with the Society since 1976, and as secretary when one did everything. Nowadays, of course, it's a bit more involved. I was editor of the transactions, then I went off to London to run a research library.
And what's the purpose of you being here today?
Well, we're to promote the Society, of course, but also to promote our special heritage.
So you've got a heritage fair coming up.
Yes, which is my man to talk to about that.
Oh, shall I talk to him?
Yes.
Do you, you got out of that one nicely.
He did that.
So tell us who you are.
Hello, my name is Jim Butler.
And what are you doing here today?
So I have a number of hats today, but one of them is as secretary for the Leicestershire Archaeological and Historical Society, and we're here to promote the society, which is our 170th year this year. We've been going for that long, which is amazing. One of the longest, oldest societies, definitely within the county, if not the country. And we're here to promote the history and heritage of Leicestershire, Leicester and Rutland, and we've been doing it for quite some time. So today we're here, obviously we'd like to recruit some new members if possible, but really we've got some of our transactions and some of our publications that we're giving away for people to come, and hopefully they'll engage them a bit more. We're advertising our history fair, which is going to happen on the 5th of July at Oakham Castle, which is a family fun day where we will have lots of other organisations like this here. It will be the launch event for the Leicestershire and Rutland Festival of Archaeology, and it'll be a great day. And again, it's our 170th year, so we're kind of treating it as a bit of a birthday party. So we're hoping it'll be great fun for everyone.
So why has there been so much interest about Leicestershire and Leicester and the area for its history and its archaeology? Why is that sustained for so long?
I think really, you know, Leicester's at the heart of the country, and unwittingly has seen many, many historical events, which, funnily enough, people outside of Leicester and Leicestershire don't seem to get. It's a bit of we don't have any, you know, big English heritage properties or National Trust properties. But in some ways, that's actually quite, when people do get into the history of Leicester and Leicestershire, then they find out how we've been at the centre of events for the best part of, you know, 1,000, 2,000 years. It really captures people's imagination because they're not expecting it. And I think we find that, you know, when we, you know, our membership and our colleagues who unearth these stories of Leicester and Leicestershire is really rich and diverse, you know, not just thousands of years ago, but like the last 50 years with, you know, the Ugandan Asian population arriving and all things like that, really captures people's imaginations and makes them realise actually there is quite a depth to Leicester's history and heritage, and it's worth exploring.
When you think in terms of archaeology, you're often thinking of prehistoric or, you know, ancient items, but there's actually an archaeology of recent. You know, if you walk along, say, the Great Central Way, you can trace Leicester's industrial heritage along there. What kind of things do you think our listeners could do as they walk around? Is there anything that you would recommend that they look out for?
Okay, I mean, there's lots out there. I mean, literally looking up is the main thing. Don't look at your phone, look up. And even like if you're walking along Narborough Road, somewhere like that, which is quite urban and you see all the shops, but you look up and suddenly the architecture of the buildings is phenomenal. Similarly, you go down the Great Central Way, you're walking down these ancient highways, some of them industrial railways, some of them have been there for millennia. I will give myself a bit of a plug if you don't mind. So I have a YouTube channel called Hidden Histories of Leicester, so you can uncover some more of those stories there going back to prehistoric times up to sort of like the 16th, 17th century. And literally, I film in those locations to try and encourage people to look at them with a fresh pair of eyes. And I think, you know, just look up and it's all there.
No, I watched your videos for the Roman ones through the pandemic. So doing things on YouTube, how did that help you tell those stories, having a platform like YouTube?
It's great because actually, you know, I do guided walks, and I can have a group of 30 people, but I can only take them around whatever distance you can cover, an hour and a half, and it's only 30 people. With YouTube, I go across the city and the county, and I take people, and I get this sort of like much broader audience are able to engage and actually recognise the history and heritage that is around them. And hopefully when they next go out, they will encounter that heritage right there.
So if anybody's checking your channel, what's the next walk that or thing that you've got planned?
So I'm currently just filming my next episode, which is called Casino Royale, The Rise and Fall of the De Beaumont Earls of Leicester. And it's about the first four Earls of Leicester. They arrived in 1066 with William the Conqueror. They're all called Robert de Beaumont, which is really confusing. But they are at the heart of every major national event. So the anarchy, the 1173 rebellion, and what they do in their personal lives. And it's not a very well-known story, so I'm hoping to have that out by Easter, and hopefully people will find that really interesting.
Do you want to tell us who you are, what you're doing here today?
Yes, I'm Denise Bolton. I come from the village of Belton. I run the village magazine there, and I'm involved with the history group and Gracedieu Priory.
And just describe for the listeners where Belton is.
Belton is north of Loughborough, northwest of Loughborough, a small village about 14 miles from Leicester, northwest direction.
And what's unique and what's specific about Belton?
It's an interesting village. It's got the Gracedieu Priory ruins, which are about 800 years old. The village itself was largely a working-class village with people working in the hosiery industry mostly, but it did have the distinguished feature of having one of the few active maypoles in the country where dances are held still, mostly by school children on May Day now. But it's also, it was one of the few surviving horse fairs until early last century when it all came to an end. But the whole of the village was taken over by the horses running up and down Long Street, children being given rides on horses and in carts, etc. So it was quite an environmentally interesting place to live in.
And so the role of preserving the story of Belton, what's your part in that? And how does the newspaper that you run play a part in that?
I'm a very new resident there. I spent the last 30 years before coming down here in Edinburgh and the 20 years before that in Norfolk, so I've travelled quite a lot. I came to Belton about 8 years ago because of family connections. And I'm one of those people who does things. I don't just sit around. I get up and join things. So I've ended up as church warden, governor of the school, running the magazine, involved with the history groups. And life is really quite full for an 82-year-old person.
And passing that, learning that story, so if you're a recent arrival, what does that facilitate? How important is it to preserve the stories of a village and town? Because each place has got a different sense of identity and a different sense of belonging, I suppose.
Absolutely. I run the Maypole magazine, which is to do with the village itself, with the history. We have lots of reminiscence pages from people who've lived and worked all their lives there. But we also use it as a point of information, entertainment and education. So I'm quite deeply involved as an ex-academic in doing things like that, and I really enjoy the research, and we get such good feedback from the villagers about the magazine, which is free and goes out to every household in the village. It's supported by the parish council.
So what, last question, what sorts of things are you looking forward to this summer that are going to be celebrating the heritage of Belton?
There will be an event on, I think it's July the 20th, the weekend of the 19th and 20th of July, at Gracedieu Priory, and also in the village itself it will be open gardens. So there's plenty to look forward to.
Do you want to tell us who you are and what you're doing here today, where you're from and what you're doing here today?
So I'm William Tusting, Chairman of Trustees of the Leather Conservation Centre. We'll be moving to Leicester into Canopy around the 1st of June this year. And it's an exciting project to have a full conservation studio dealing with leather in Leicester.
So what's Canopy and why is leather important to be preserved and understood?
So Canopy is a new building that Leicester County Council have spent a large amount of money developing off King Street at the end of New Walk. And leather is a sustainable product. It's been used for time immemorial, and we conserve items from Egyptian underwear to relatively modern 1960s cars and anything in between.
Because leather was I suppose it was the core, because before plastics, before synthetic materials, you'd either have to make it through rope and fabric or leather. What was the advantage of using leather as opposed to other things that were commonly available? Give us a time period and an example of when it was kind of mainly used.
So leather generally comes in a big sheet or a hide, so you very useful for making clothing, anything where you need a large piece. You don't have to weave it, you don't have to do a lot of work to it to be able to use it straight away. You could use it dried, you can then tan it, and the other beauty of it is it's sustainable, it's biodegradable. It's not like modern plastics. So a lot of things that modern plastics can do, leather can do just as well, if not better.
And typically in a social use, was there a divide between who had leather goods and who didn't?
No, not really. Everything from the basic, say if you said a Roman private in the Lois, he would have leather shoes, and the emperor would have a leather cloak. I mean, leather is so universal and was not particularly used in a social way. Some leathers were later on, when they started gilding them and painting them, those leathers were high status. But generally, leather could be used right from, protecting your feet to making a really good waterproof coat.
And last question, what's the hardest part of preserving leather from the past, the objects that are made of leather that have been handed down to us?
Okay, so our conservation priorities are in preserving leather depends on the use that the client wants. So a museum article, say a Roman shoe, we would conserve that to stop it deteriorating, because it's just going to be on display. But if we were doing that for a modern, say a 1906 car seat, we might conserve that to preserve all the leather that's there, but also make it usable, that it can be actually used and displayed in use. And we have the skill set to do either level of conservation.
Hello, I'm James Gunn. I'm from the Leicester Civic Society. We're here to introduce people to the Civic Society. We've been in existence from 1971, supporting Leicester, really, Myself, I'm the events and walks coordinator. So we have a walks program, guided walks program around Leicester, various parts of Leicester. This year we have 11 walks planned. Our first walk was last Saturday, and they're following on now until into October.
And what kind of things do those walks focus on?
Generally, they're focusing on just the history of Leicester. I'm doing a walk down Humberston Gate in May. I'm doing one down Wharf Street. I've done one around the Cultural Quarter. Then also we go out to North Gates, and we've done a walk out there from St Margaret's over to there. And then also there's the terracotta plaques, which are dotted around Leicester. There's 39 of those, which has been refurbished and added to. So we have three walks featuring those this month, next month, and the following month.
Now, for somebody who's never been on a walk like this, who's listening to this, and what would you say it was like? What's it about? What's the benefit of not just looking at photographs or looking in a book at these things, but actually being out in the town and the place itself?
Yes, I think part of it is the fact that we sometimes take people down streets where they wouldn't normally go. And we can introduce them to the factories and the factory owners. And obviously some of these factories employed hundreds of people, if not thousands of people. So very important to Leicester. But they're generally in parts of Leicester, like I say, where, well, they're not near the shops. So a lot of people don't go. And on my own walks, I enjoy talking about the social side of the area as well, going back sort of 100, 150 years. That's what I enjoy talking about. So yeah, people are generally interested to see that. Also include old photos of how the area looked beforehand, and obviously compare it to now, and you know, often it's completely changed, but a lot of people do still remember the old shops, say down Wharf Street, where there were a lot of shops down there, all now gone, but there's a lot of history there.
And has that changed for you in terms of what your favourite parts of the city or the town are?
I suppose I would say that I know more about those parts of Leicester than I ever did before. There's a lot of information out there, whether it's books or on the internet, about Leicester, the old pubs, the old shops, old factories, and the old, you know, people who were around in those days. And that's information I never knew. So that's really what I like to convey back to the people who are on my walks, to say, well, yeah, there's a lot of history, which is to a certain extent hidden away, but you can delve into it by looking at the books or looking at, or I give the talk, and you know, people seem interested.
And I suppose last question: Leicester's it is a place of kind of churn and change. With people coming together to do this as a social activity, how do you keep that balance between, well, it's a living city and it's got to move on, but also all of those stories that were there that are kind of, they're just memories now?
Yes. Well, obviously Leicester is a very old city. It's one of the oldest cities, or one of the oldest towns in the country, 2,000 years of history. And I like to, I'm not one to shirk away from the fact that parts of Leicester have been demolished and replaced by large chunks of concrete. You know, that's a fact, and that's the way it was. You know, we go back 50 or 60 years and that was deemed progress. Nowadays we'd probably think, well, let's at least keep the facades and put the new build behind it. And generally that's sort of, most people on the walks are accepting of the fact that things do progress and we change and society changes, and you know, what we need changes, our needs. So that's, yeah, really to convey that to people, and they're always generally fairly accepting of that.
Hello, my name's Alison Clegg. I'm Senior Curator for Leicestershire County Museums. I'm here on the Culture Leicestershire stall. So we're the service that covers museums, heritage libraries and creative learning services in the county.
Now, why is it important that we continue to invest in culture and heritage and our museums and libraries?
Well, it's such an important resource for the community in terms of being able to understand our past, understand our present, hopefully inspire us for the future as well. We do a lot of work with volunteers, with community groups, so it's something that, you know, we're really keen to reach out and work with more people in our community to make those collections more relevant to them, uncover stories that maybe we haven't told before, and share our wonderful collections and resources with them.
Now, many of our listeners on Sore Sound are relatively new to the city, and they might not have used our countywide. If you were talking to somebody and say, you know, what would they anticipate in terms of how they engage with, you know, visit? What those basic tips and things?
Well, I mean, we try and be open. As open as possible to everybody. Where I work at one of our collection centres, so people are welcome to come and visit, but they have to make an appointment. But we do have museums in the main market towns, so in Loughborough, in Market Harbour and in Melton Mowbray. And those museums are free and they've got wonderful displays. So, for example, today we've got a replica of the Hallerton helmet with us, a 3D print. But at Harbour Museum, there's a wonderful display showing the original helmet and two magnificent replicas that we had made last year. And then that's part of the library as well. So the museum and library are all on the same floor in the Symington building. So there's lots to do. It's really family friendly. All we ask is, you know, don't eat and drink in there. But, you know, otherwise, you know, we try and be as welcoming as possible. And the same in our other venues as well. You know, we've all they've all got Visit England sort of really high scores because they're great at welcoming people. We've also got Bosworth Battlefield and the 1620s House and Garden at Donington the Heath, which are more rural but still really welcoming, and there's lots to do for families.
Now that the weather's changing and it's spring, what are you looking forward to in terms of each of the museums that you visit in the area?
Oh gosh, well, like at the 1620s House at Donington the Heath, the gardens are magnificent, so it's always a joy to go and see those gardens and enjoy some delicious cake in the cafe there. At Melton Museum, we've been working on a really interesting project based around Revealing Villiers, which looks at LGBTQ history. And we're just about to install next week the second phase of that, which is an artist-led response to that with some really vibrant and vivid and meaningful LGBTQ community response to that exhibition. So it'll be something really different for Melton and something really positive, hopefully.
And as a kid, can you remember back to visiting a museum? What stuck in your mind that inspired you to get into heritage and museums?
Well, I'm from the Isle of Man originally, so the Manx Museum in Douglas was my big inspiration. They had wonderful things there, and they still do, and a great big skeleton of an Irish deer, which was always stuck in my mind. So, yeah, that was my inspiration.
I'm Nisha Papat, and I'm here with the UK South Asian Digital Archive, and we're here talking to people about what we're doing around the archive and signing people up to, if they want to be volunteers, donate anything to the archive, or just find out more about us.
So tell us a bit about the archive.
Okay, so we only launched the project in October, and at the moment we're getting all the logistics ready, like the website, the catalogue, and we've been talking to a lot of groups and individuals about stories that they can deposit on there. Currently there is a lot of South Asian material around, but it's scattered all over the country, and the idea of the UK South Asian Digital Archive was to bring it all into one place, or at least link it when we couldn't bring it together. So yeah.
So what kind of stories are you picking up in Leicester?
So we're picking up loads of stories about people's arrival in Leicester, the kind of jobs and the industries they've worked in. We had some amazing stories about the first sort of South Asian policeman in Leicester. So there's loads of stories around what people have done over the years. The industry ones in particular are quite interesting, and how people worked across industries and that. We picked up stories around schooling and, you know, actually being a student in Leicester. And then we've also got stories of people who struggled when they actually first came to the city, but then have then gone on to become people who love Leicester and really well settled in Leicester.
One of the challenges of an archive is to preserve things from the past, but to anticipate in the future how people will appreciate their history and their heritage and their past. What do you think the archive will achieve in terms of what you see, how it might look in, say, 10 years' time when people think about now? What things do you think they'll notice have changed within the South Asian communities and how that's developing and growing?
So one of the things when we've started to talk to people about archives is that a lot of people just don't understand archives. You know, if you talk to them about an exhibition or an event, they actually get it. But when you start talking about archives, it's as if a curtain goes up. So with the digital archive, we obviously will have the catalogue, which will have information that historians, researchers, students can access. But what we want to do is quite a lot of curated stuff on the archive. So whether they're microsites or how we do it is something we're looking at now. But the idea is to have stories that will resonate to different generations around either their own stories, so their community stories or their family stories, but also very much about this is what happened 10 years ago and here we are. And, you know, it's still going on. How do we actually relate to this? And the other audience, obviously, for us is schools. And it's what resources can we create that encourage school children to start or teachers to actually start looking at the archive and seeing, is this something that could be taught in schools and how does it link in with the curriculum?
So last question is, what are you looking forward to collecting and gathering? What are the things that you personally enjoy that when you gather those stories and those items of interest, let's call it that, then what are you looking forward to?
So what I'm looking forward to is being able to, I mean, I like the idea of curating those stories, because I feel people get so much more out of that rather than just listening to an oral history for 2 hours. If it's curated and it's part of an overall story, that's what I'm looking forward to sharing with people those stories in a much more curated way and in a much more interesting way so they can access those. And the great thing with a digital archive, obviously there is costs in terms of digitising and all that, is that we can put so much more on. Whereas if you're doing an exhibition or you're doing a physical archive, there's always the limitations around space. Whereas we feel with the digital that, you know, yes, it's going to cost in terms of how much space we have, but we can be far more creative and bring things to life for people. We also plan to do events online as well as panel discussions, activity that people can participate in. So we also feel it makes it really accessible to people across the country, because we're obviously based in Leicester and it's a UK-wide archive. So a lot of digital stuff. We will be going around the country, but it makes it accessible.
Start off by telling us who you are, who you work with, and what you're doing here today.
Hi, I'm Simon Dixon. I'm Associate Director for Community and Heritage in Library Learning Services at the University. My team looks after the university's rare books, archives and manuscripts. And today we're showcasing one of our manuscripts in particular. This is an 18th and 19th century recipe book. It's known to us as Rebecca Dixon's recipe book because it has her name written inside the front cover. But actually it's clearly something that was used by different members of the same household and successive generations, because it's got lots of different handwriting in, all recording, documenting different culinary recipes, medicinal recipes, recipes for wine and other drinks, preserves. Preserving things was obviously very important in the 18th and 19th century. And earlier today we had Josh Smalley from our School of Chemistry and former Bake Off finalist demonstrating how to make one of the recipes from the recipe book. So it's been a great day. We've had lots of interest, we're looking forward to being able to share this with more people when we publish it online later in the year.
So why and how have recipe books changed? Because now it's a big industry, isn't it? When you look at a recipe book, you think of it as a modern thing. What's different with it now?
So you did have published recipe books in the 18th and 19th centuries, one of the most famous being Mrs. Beaton's recipe book. But it was also very common for people to keep their own manuscript handwritten record of the recipes that they used, but also recipes that they circulated with other people. And a book like this would be used not just for culinary recipes, so you've got cakes in here, you've got mince pies, you've got partridge pie, but also you'd find medicinal recipes as well. So unlike today, where you'd be more expecting just to find, you know, things you'd eat, in the 19th century, you'd also record sort of homemade remedies. So this recipe here is Dr. Hepbaum's recipe for a pain in the stomach. And he recommends using a mixture of rhubarb, orange peel, something called gentian root, cardamom seeds, and a few other things, and taking 3 spoonfuls at night before going to bed and 2 in the morning, and that would hopefully sort out your stomach ache.
Now, the obvious question is, have you tried that recipe?
I haven't tried that recipe, no. But what we have tried today is we've tried the recipe for queen cakes, which is a little bit more appetising sounding. And that's been baked for us by Josh Smalley. And it was delicious. He's done a fantastic job of converting what's quite a difficult to interpret 19th century recipe into something that you can cook today.
So these tell us a lot more than just the recipe. It's more than just a set of instructions, isn't it? It's like it indicates what the culture was at the time and where this was positioned in the class structure and things like that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it really kind of takes you into a Victorian kitchen, if you like. And you can also get a sense of the kind of networks and the relationships people would have had within the local community. So one of the recipes, the recipe for a pickle in a ham, which is pickling ham, has another name on it, Mrs. Robert Johnson. So that recipe was obviously given to the owner of the recipe book by someone else. And we have that, you find that quite a lot in recipe books like this, that you can see people within the local community exchanging recipes. But also then the writer of the book has made comments on which ones they liked and which ones they weren't so keen on. So there's a recipe for what they describe as an excellent orange cake. And then they sort of say things like, you can do it like this, but I like to do it like that, and that kind of thing. So so it really kind of gives you a kind of a lens into the kitchen, but also into the recipes people used and the produce that they would have had available to them at the time.
And the digital version of this you mentioned, where will that be available?
So that will be available on our Special Collections Exhibitions website. I'm still working on it at the moment, but it should be available hopefully in the summer. And people will then be able to access the recipes, but also transcripts that have been done by our fantastic team of volunteers from the Friends of the Centre for Regional and Local History here at the University.
I'm Rob. I live in Anstey in Leicestershire. I'm here today at the Heritage Hub to I'm here to associate myself with Richard III Society because I'm Richard III in Leicester, visitor centre, and I'm here basically with the Leicester Museums group. And we are giving out leaflets and we are explaining things to people when they want to know some answers, and basically that's what we're doing.
It's 10 years since the reinterment.
On the 26th of March it will be 10 years exactly, yeah.
How's the appreciation and understanding of that changed over the last 10 years now?
I think with a lot of documentaries that have been on recently, I think the tendency is that people now consider Richard to be more of a villain than he probably was, because they think he was involved in the Princes in the Tower. I have I have grave doubts about that, because he had no need to kill his nephews, because he had already made them illegitimate, and there was absolutely no reason for him to kill them. It would have been far worse for him had he killed them. He would have been in a much more difficult position than he was had he left them alive, and I believe that's what he did.
In a way, the Richard III has become a kind of a symbol for Leicester. Why has it become a symbol? What is important for Leicester about identifying
with, I mean, you speak to people in York and they're a bit, you know, they're not so sure that he should be in Leicester. Why is Leicester so convinced that Richard III is a Leicester iconic symbol for the city?
Well, he was killed at the Battle of Bosworth, 22nd of August, 1485, and he was brought to Leicester over the back of a horse and buried in the Grey Friars. Archaeology-wise, he's buried in exactly the right place, because archaeology-wise, if a king dies in battle, he's buried in the nearest consecrated ground, and the nearest consecrated ground was in Leicester. Kings have been killed in France, and they were buried in France. They weren't brought home. Archaeology-wise, is in exactly the right place. And after all, York has so many other things already, and we needed Richard to help our tourist industry, I believe, and that's proven to be exactly the case.
And what draws you into this story, this being part of the preservation and heritage of that story?
I've always been a history buff, and Richard III is only one of four of the sites that I cover. I love history, and Richard III's story is so unique and so vital for preservation that's why I was involved. I've been involved with them now nearly 3 years, and I love every minute I'm there. I feel very privileged to stand by his graveside and tell his story.
My name is Mike Greenwood. I'm the Director of Archives and Research at the Leicester Transport Heritage Trust.
And what does that involve?
We basically represent the history of road transport in Leicester, represent that. We have a collection in the order of 18 double-deck buses, ranging from about 1950 to the 1980s. We occupy an Edwardian tram depot at Stoneygut, which is probably one of the city's best-kept secrets. It's been there since 1904, but it's set back from the road, and so most people miss it. And have open days there, and it's still in very, very original condition. Still got tram lines down in the actual building. So we always enjoy greeting people to come along to that. And coming, the first open day there, incidentally, is on Easter Sunday, 21st of April. We've also got a major event at Quorn and Woodhouse Station that we partner with the Great Central Railway on the weekend of May the 17th and 18th, where we'll have about 50 heritage buses running around on three or four different routes. And I'm just scraping because I'm getting a dinosaur coming by me. And all our bus services are free. So we give people free bus rides, and it's always enjoyed by ages young and old.
Now, there's one thing that's different about your object of interest, which is that the vast majority of everybody I've spoken to today is fixed in one place, or is about that place. But transport is mobile. What challenges does that present for what you do, and how do you incorporate that? You know, what do you do to meet those challenges?
Yeah, I mean, we are a charitable organisation, and we represent Leicestershire and Rutland, so we have a little bit of a boundary, but there's masses of, and especially road transport, because whilst we have buses, and we've got a milk float and a T-van in the collection as well, we also embrace people who remember their cars of those days, and we've got a massive collection. We've got about 250,000 objects in our collection, a lot of which are photographs of street scenes, which really people identify with. It's all about identification. But we're also a little bit like a mobile museum, because our buses, say from 1950 to the 1980s, we can take those out to the people rather than them coming to us. We also get involved with memory cafes with people with dementia or Alzheimer's, where we can, with all our objects that we've got, they immediately see things that they remember from different time periods, and they are exceptionally successful and beneficial to both ourselves and to the people receiving that sort of days of remembering things. Yeah.
So here's a last question for you. What's your favourite vehicle? Is it whether it's public transport vehicle, a private transport vehicle, what's your favourite? What's the one that kind of gives you goosebumps now?
that's quite an easy question for me. In Leicester and Leicestershire, the main operators were the municipal operator, Leicester City Transport, and serving more into the counties was a company called Midland Red. The Midland Red was very unique. It was Birmingham-based, but it served the whole of the Midlands, and they built their own vehicles. Very unique, and we're very fortunate we've got a Midland Red bus in our collection, which is my favourite. I drive that, and it's a joy to drive. It always puts a smile on my face.
So you've been listening to Spotlight on Heritage with me, Rob Watson, and I've been wandering around chatting to people, as you've heard all day, but John's been stood talking to people in one place. How's your day been so far?
I've had a really good day, actually. I think for me, I've always enjoyed talking to people. And so to be at an event like this is great, because it's about going off and saying hi to people you've not seen for a while, maybe not been to a Saturday Heritage Fair we organise for a while, catching up with where they're at, what projects they've got going on. But also I think it's just meeting strangers who wander by and are brought in by the camera collection, or seeing some of the old memorabilia from family members and stuff from, you know, serving in the military. And you have these conversations and you realise all of these stories that are out there, if it weren't for an event like this, or our Saturday Heritage Fairs, or Military History Live, or any of those Facebook groups, if you like, where do people share these stories about their family's past? Because we know about World War One and World War Two and the Olympics, and we know all these big stuff, facts and figures, but actually, in this room here, the sum of all the stories of people, either their own personal experience, lived experience, or people in their family, or anything like that, I mean, that this will tell you actually more about that period of time than just reading a book telling you about, you know, when it started, who finished, who won, how many died, that kind of stuff. So I think it's fascinating. And congratulations to Professor Sarah Scott and her team for pulling off this Heritage Hub thing again. You know, really good, bigger and better than last year. I'm looking forward to next year. I'll be here soon enough.